It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me? Or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Good evening. In a landmark ruling, the Supreme Court today legalized abortions. The majority in cases from Texas and Georgia said that the decision to end a pregnancy during the first 3 months belongs to the woman and her doctor, not the government. Thus, the anti-abortion laws of 46 states were rendered unconstitutional.
That was the voice of Walter Cronkite on January the 22nd of 1973. He was the voice that Americans trusted to deliver the news. And as we'll discover in our discussion with our next guest, he was a reliable pawn for the pro-abortion movement. CBS News had a report that day also, which fills in more of the blanks on that decision known as Roe versus Wade. Let's listen.
In two related cases and eight separate opinions, the nine justices made abortion largely a private matter and ordered the states to make no laws forbidding it, except possibly during the final months. The court split 7-2 with Justices Byron White and William Rehnquist dissenting. In effect, the court makes abortion subject only to the decision of the pregnant woman's doctor. It ruled that states may make no laws restricting a doctor's right to decide his patient needs an abortion and to carry out that abortion during the first 3 months of a pregnancy. After that comparatively safe 3-month period, abortions may be regulated, but not prohibited by state law and for the benefit of the mother's health alone. Abortion is somewhat more dangerous at this stage, and states may insist, for example, that they be performed in regulated hospitals. Only in the final stages of pregnancy may states intervene and say no to abortion. The court's decision, written by Justice Blackmun, thus sets limits on the right to abortion on demand. One limit is the time when doctors believe the fetus may be able to survive outside the mother's womb. At that point, usually in the 7th month of pregnancy, the state may take legal action to protect the unborn child, even forbidding abortion, except to protect the mother. The newly liberalized abortion law brought immediate reaction.
I think that to raise the dignity of woman and give her freedom of choice in this area is an extraordinary event. And I think that January 22nd, 1973 would be an historic day.
In this instance, the Supreme Court has withdrawn protection for the human rights of unborn children, and it is teaching people that abortion is a rather innocuous procedure provided that there are proper legal safeguards. I think that the judgment of the court will do a great deal to tear down the respect previously accorded human life in our culture.
All right, that was a report from CBS News in 1973, and since that decision, what George Herman said on CBS News, he didn't say it very clearly, was that not only was abortion made legal in all 50 states, it was made legal for all 9 months of pregnancy. Only the states could intervene, and at that point, they hadn't said anything because this was a shock to the United States. Since that time, almost 60 million babies have been aborted. That was 45 years ago. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Bob Knight joins us. Bob is a longtime warrior in the pro-life movement. He's an author. He's a contributor to the Washington Times. He writes great pieces that are printed everywhere. We're going to talk about one of his Washington Times articles just today called The Deceitful Road to Abortion. He also formerly was with the American Conservative Union and way, way back was a news writer for the Los Angeles Times. But I met Bob when I met him in so many different ways. I met him when I heard him first present when I was a talk show host for Salem Radio. And he was teaching us so many things about what was happening in culture. But later, when I became president of Concerned Women for America, Bob was the director of our Culture and Family Institute. Honestly, I was the boss, but I learned so much from Bob Knight, and it is always a privilege and a pleasure to talk to him. Bob, thanks for joining me today.
Well, thank you, Sandy, and thanks for the kind introduction.
Hey, I want to ask you something. Where were you in January of 1973? Do you remember what you were doing and where you were when this decision was made?
Oh, gosh, I honestly don't. I was still in college, and I might have been on the ski slopes, for all I know. It was January.
Okay, so what was the catalyst that actually drew you into this particular topic? Or this issue?
Oh, well, it wasn't just this topic. It was the whole idea of who we are, and is God real? Does God have a plan for humanity and the family? And it just, I just gradually over the years realized that there was an anti-family, anti-life agenda underway, and just read a lot of conservative authors and a lot of Christian authors, and really became a born-again believer in 1986. That's when my wife and I were in California while I was working for the LA Times. We heard the gospel, and we had heard it over and over, but we finally bent our knee. There's quite a difference, knowing about it and actually submitting to the authority of Christ. And, of course, our lives were never the same after that. So much better. But that put me at odds with my fellow editors at the Los Angeles Times. I was already conservative, so you can imagine being a Christian conservative. So I stayed a few more years there and then went on and eventually ended up in Washington. But I learned a lot from our dear friend Mike Schwartz, and you worked with Mike at CWA. He was the government relations director, and Mike was a brilliant guy, and he's the guy who disabused me of being a libertarian. He said, "Bob, let me ask you this. Are you for aborting babies?" I said, "No." "Are you for gay marriage?" "No." "Do you think pornography ought to be legal everywhere?" "No." He says, "Bob, you're not a libertarian. You're a conservative." Because I was very anti-government. I thought the government was getting too big and centralized, and I still feel that way. And they take too much of our treasure and so forth. But the libertarians just see government as an evil. They don't see that man has evil in his heart, and that we do need a culture of life that respects it. And the government plays a role in that.
Well, that's a great background for our discussion about this particular issue. I certainly remember that decision. And Bob, I hardly even knew what abortion was. I have to tell you, I was very young. Well, I was young. I was 21. And I saw a brochure right after this decision. I wasn't paying any attention. And I saw pictures of abortion for the first time in my life. And I have to tell you, I was already a serious follower of Christ, but politically didn't really know much. And I was so gripped. And so it's interesting that our paths crossed at CWA. We later went on to, you produced for us a video which exposed the lies around Roe versus Wade. It was a great video, and I had the privilege of you directed as I hosted. And I think it was a powerful video. We used a lot of that old footage. And before we kind of cast an idea of what's happened in this last 45 years, let's go back just for a second and highlight some of the lies that I still don't think people know, that Roe versus Wade and the Doe versus Bolton companion case were based on. Can you just kind of touch on a few of those?
Yeah, what I'll do is give a quick summary of the column, and it's kind of a timeline. In Roe v. Wade, Norma McCorvey was convinced that she should tell people she was gang raped, and she wasn't. And her lawyers were very dishonest to her. And later, after she became a Christian, she said, "You know, I was kind of pushed along with this. I told lies. The whole case is based on a lie, and now I'm pro-life." In Doe v. Bolton, same thing. Sandra Cano was told she signed a statement saying she wanted an abortion. She didn't. She was looking for a way out, and they used it. And later, she said Doe v. Bolton was based on a lie and deceit. It needs to be retried or overturned. Those were the two key cases. But my column notes that this started long ago. It started in Griswold versus Connecticut in 1965. And I got this from Mike Schwartz's little booklet, The Supreme Court of the U.S. versus the American Family. That's where they created the right of privacy. And they said it came from a penumbra in the Constitution emanating from civil rights guarantees. But they based it on the sanctity of marriage. They said the state cannot interfere in a marriage. So they struck down a birth control law in Connecticut that they couldn't sell contraceptives to married couples. So as Mike Schwartz put it, and Mike was a devout Catholic who was not a fan of contraceptives, he said the justices could have struck down the law because it was archaic. People weren't obeying it. It really was out of touch with the times. But instead, they created this new right. Then here's the bait and switch. They took that new right of privacy they created based solely on marriage's supreme status, and then they applied it to unmarried people, and then they applied it to individuals. So they went on and they ended up at Roe v. Wade saying, well, the right of privacy said it's just between a woman and her doctor. So this right of privacy established on the sanctity of marriage was suddenly used to say you can kill unborn children. They went on even after that. And there are many other cases, the Casey, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which really put Roe in stone, even though it limited it somewhat. But they use the same logic. So you have the seminal cases of abortion based on lies, and you have the central premise of that an abortion is a constitutional right based on something entirely different from what it is.
And Bob, as I understand from what you've written here, and you quoted our dear departed friend Michael Schwartz, who we both love so much, who was really a champion in this movement, a champion whose name so many people have not heard, but it would be hard to trace Michael's fingerprints on all of the good things that happened to fight this. But he points out that right to privacy was what came from the idea that marriage was so sacred that a couple had the right to decide between themselves if they wanted to practice contraception. And the original Griswold case had to do with letting couples use contraception because of the sacredness of their union, they should be able to decide. And then they've used that right to privacy now to completely deconstruct the family and apply it to just personal actions so that it gives license to do almost anything. That's one of the biggest ironies, I think, don't you?
Oh, yeah. They take something sacred and they use it as a hammer to hammer all the laws. And this goes beyond even abortion, Sandy, because they use it to hammer the laws against obscenity and pornography, saying, you know, we're all just autonomous individuals, so we can decide whatever we want. There really is no morality. All privacy and choice are the only solid values. So therefore, everybody's entitled to do whatever they want at any time. They've changed liberty, which is an ordered concept. Our founders said that we can have liberty, but it has to be for people who are disciplined, who have a higher moral set of values. Absent that, it won't work. I'm paraphrasing. But what they've done is they've knocked down all the protections for a family-based culture. Part of this was the problem in the Constitution itself, as Mike Schwartz pointed out. It was hatched during a time when the Enlightenment was reigning supreme and the individual was emerging. And the Constitution doesn't mention the family at all, and so it establishes rights based only on the individual. Now, we know individuals aren't islands. We are sons and daughters. We're fathers and mothers. We're aunts and uncles. We're grandparents. So this is an entirely unrealistic view of human beings. So if the court had started saying, you know, marriage is sacred, and therefore families have some rights too, that would have been great, but it went the other way instead.
All right. The article that Bob just wrote is called The Deceitful Road to Abortion, and we'll put this on our Facebook page, but the point is this is the beginnings of it so that you understand. Now, 45 years. We have had abortion, almost 60 million babies aborted. It is a startling story, but it's not over yet. And so we work and we tell the truth, and the huge march and rally in the Washington is taking place. And we'll keep fighting until we turn this back. Bob Knight, thank you so much for joining me. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
My name is Bernadette Casey. I go to Fresno State University. So my club on campus, Fresno State Students for Life, got permission from the university to chalk positive, life-affirming messages on campus. And just as we were finishing up, Dr. Thatcher came up to me and told me he would be coming back and erasing those messages. And that's exactly what he did. And he ended up recruiting students in the process. And that's when I started recording. When I asked him why he was erasing our messages, he said that it was his free speech rights to censor our free speech rights. It was just very shocking because he is a university professor that should be encouraging free speech rights and not erasing them. And especially because he recruited students to help him in the process, that's teaching students that this is something that's okay. And it's really just wrong. Students for Life of America is so important because I immediately contacted my regional coordinator, Camille, and she got me connected with Alliance Defending Freedom. I did feel supported after this happened. She was able to give me all the resources I needed to start this legal action that I would take. And I knew that this would be something that could help even other groups on campus because, you know, it might not just be our free speech rights that are violated, it could be other clubs too. They give us the resources to be able to reach students on campus. Everything from supporting pregnant and parenting students on campus to providing large displays that really catch students' eye. And we get to have a conversation with them, and we get to be trained to have a conversation with students. And that's something that people might be afraid to do at first, but if you're given the tools, then we're definitely encouraged to go out and talk with students because that's really the way to reach them. My hope for our nation is that we will see the truth about abortion and that we will come to believe that this is something that is tearing us apart. I believe we're going to abolish abortion in our lifetime. With our young generation coming up, we are the pro-life generation. I can see this happening in the near future.
All right, Sandy Rios back with you. That's a young lady named Bernadette Casey from Fresno State University. And as she explained to you, she is with Students for Life. Things are changing. And after that recap that we just did on the dreadful history of Roe versus Wade, the fact that almost 60 million babies have been aborted since 1973. And as my generation passes on after fighting and fighting and fighting, and sometimes just it's 45 years that it's still legal. As we pass the baton to the next generation, it's encouraging to hear their optimism and also their willingness to fight because they're going to have that. The founder and president of Students for Life joins me now. Her name is Kristen Hawkins, and Kristen has been one of the best warriors on this issue. I'm telling you, if I have to pass the baton, I'd pass it to Kristen. Kristen, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me today, Sandy.
You know, because we started with that clip, if you were to just say your assessment of what's happening on college campuses nationwide in regard to the life, the pro-life issue, how would you describe it? Is it thriving, surviving, or what is it?
I think we're thriving. We definitely have the momentum on our side, and we've had the momentum for a number of years now. If you look, Planned Parenthood just released their annual report during Christmas holiday, hoping no one would read it, and they boasted that they had started 50 campus pro-abortion groups last year. We started over 150 Students for Life groups last year, and we've been doing that every single year for the past 10 years. We now have over 1,200 groups that we serve on high schools and colleges all across the country. And Planned Parenthood is bragging about having easily 400, 300 pro-abortion groups. This generation is pro-life. We view abortion differently than past generations. We've seen our brothers and sisters via ultrasound. I think the difficulty we face right now as pro-lifers has been this backlash in censorship and really this push for censorship on college campuses, the administration, and what Bernadette talked about with that one professor on her campus at Fresno State attacking her group's display.
You know, that's a very good point, Kristen. And of course, it's the same thing with the 4D ultrasounds. The truth, when it can be told, and the reasons when they can be given are just truth and persuasive. And women, 80% of them decide to keep their babies after actually seeing their babies before When I was young, they told us it was a blob of tissue. Nothing to worry about, you know, nothing to see here, just a blob. And so when the lies are exposed, it's powerful. So you're right to say that as long as we can speak, we can persuade. But, of course, that is the problem. All right, so you have 1,200 groups. That's just amazing. And this is the other thing, Kristen, the approach. The approach that you use to persuade college students, how would you describe that? I think we have to appeal to people based on their knowledge and where they are. So how do you do that?
That's right. And really when we go to college campuses and high school students, we talk about abortion as the human rights issue that it is. And so we usually take, you know, it's a science-based approach of here's a child in utero. You understand and you acknowledge that this is a human being. Why does that human being not have the same rights that you and I do to live? And it's a very simple approach that way. And something that I think is a little different from past generations. But we really start out with just focusing on human rights.
You know, Kristen, as I've watched this develop through the years, it's really become very apparent to me. I've known it for a long time, but it's becoming more apparent. That the irony of this, we were playing an old clip of the day that, you know, January 22nd of 1973, before you joined me, and there were men weighing in on this issue. Oh, this is a new day for freedom for women. And mm-hmm. I'm thinking to myself, you know, no, it's actually a new day of freedom for men. Men that want to have no responsibility in their sexual activity. And it's still the women who pay the price for that. I don't care if women say that now they're free to be like men, which in some ways they are, but they are the ones who have to go through this procedure. They are the ones who bear the pain of it emotionally. Now, men do too sometimes, but women really are the ones who suffer from this. Sometimes they can't even bear children later, and we could go on and on with that. But have you ever tried, and do you think that would resonate with young women, that this is also an issue of women's rights and of men getting license to behave without responsibility?
That's absolutely right. And we do use that messaging of you deserve better. You know, something that works when we talk about Planned Parenthood a lot on college campuses is really their predatory business cycle of how they've set up shop. They try to get in as soon as possible, as early as possible, in middle schools and high schools, to offer their sex ed curriculum because they want to build a relationship with you. They want to build a relationship with you because they know every time you walk in their doors, it's money in their pocket. And you deserve better than Planned Parenthood preying upon you. You deserve real nonviolent health care. And those are talking points that we use every single day on college campuses. Even with pro-choice students, students who disagree with us about the issue of abortion, we can get them to see very clearly the predatory nature of the abortion industry.
Love it. That's why Students for Life is so effective. Kristen, it's funny because you've grown up doing this. I mean, you're not old, but you were really young when you started this. And then you were a young mom, and now you're still swinging away at it. But now you're a grown-up. And actually, you were invited to Washington because you've been invited to meetings in the White House. Now, I have to ask you, as you have tracked what's happened under the Trump administration, it's been a year now, mm-hmm. almost a year. What do you see from his presidency on this issue? Any good signs, bad signs, any movement?
I see a lot of good signs coming out of the White House. In fact, today I'm at the White House calling you. And you know, I've seen a lot of positive signs. I think a lot of people, pro-lifers, were apprehensive about electing President Trump as to whether or not he would really live up to those pro-life promises that he made during the election. And he has done that. You know, Neil Gorsuch was confirmed to the Supreme Court. We are one vote away from having a pro-life majority in the Supreme Court that could overturn Roe and Doe and take abortion back to the states. That would be huge. I mean, millions would be saved. President Trump has done, if you even look in the administration, I have several friends who are working at the Department of Health and Human Services, good pro-life leaders who left their command posts at the pro-life movement and have gone to serve in the federal government right there where all that money was going in and out to abortionists. And there's a lot of things going on right now there at HHS that I'm really excited about. And just seeing the change and the kind of those, trying to get those grinding wheels of bureaucracy and government to kind of move and shift, and it's starting to happen. So I think we can be really excited. I mean, one of the first actions President Trump took upon entering the White House was reinstating the Mexico City policy and then expanding it. He stood up and spoken loudly in favor of conscience and religious freedom. January 16th, he proclaimed Religious Freedom Day. So we have the support there in the White House. But I think there's, obviously, you know me, Sandy, there's a lot more that needs to be done, and there could be more that gets done in Washington that's not being done right now.
Yes, and we're going to talk about that. And let me explain, Kristen, because this is your bailiwick and my secondary bailiwick, because I have so many bailiwicks. But the Mexico City policy forbade federal dollars to be spent on abortions. And that's what President Trump reinstated.
Internationally, yes.
Internationally. Mm-hmm. So that's...
And President Trump has promised to sign into law, you know, the No Taxpayer from the Abortion Act, which would codify the Hyde Amendment, which prevents, you know, U.S. taxpayer dollars from funding abortions here in the United States. That has not been passed out of the Senate yet. He's promised to sign into law the 20-week pain capable will, which will ban abortions at the point where children have been scientifically proven to feel pain. That has yet to pass the Senate. He has promised to sign into law a bill that would defund Planned Parenthood as long as they continue to commit abortions. That has yet been passed the Senate. Are you noticing a pattern here?
I'm noticing a pattern here. And Kristen, indulge me for a second. I guess I'm on a nostalgic run today because I'm just remembering a lot of things. The Mexico City policy, as you said, bans federal dollars from international policy from being spent on abortion. And, of course, that was so abused in the last administration and under the Clintons. A Hyde Amendment is domestic. And that reminds me, Congressman Henry Hyde was a very good friend of mine. I'm from Chicago. I knew him for years before I ever came to Washington. I have a picture of him pushing my severely disabled daughter in a wheelchair. And so he was the one who was such a pro-life champion in the House. And he's the one who saw the Hyde Amendment passed, and now they're having to still fight for it, which leads me to Congress. So, Kristen, the Congress now, with the Republican majority, almost all of them run and say that they're pro-life. You know that. They have that. I can't think of any exceptions in the Republican Party. Oh, maybe. Yes, I can. Why would I say that? Of course I can. Murkowski and many others, Susan Collins. But in the House, for the most part, they are pro-life. And yet, when it comes to actually passing pro-life legislation, they don't seem all that enthused. It seems that they, every year for the National March for Life, they throw us a bone. So what's going on with Congress this year? What bone are they throwing? Or are they doing something meaningful?
Sure. Well, I think the House is going to repass the Born Alive Infant Protection Act this week. That is the federal ban on the infanticide of killing an infant who's been born alive during an abortion procedure. And it's going to actually add criminal penalties. So now if you are caught and found guilty of refusing to aid a child who's been born alive during an abortion, there will be a criminal penalty you will face. So that's what the House is passing. That, once again, is going to go over to the Senate. The challenge is everything's resting at the feet of the U.S. Senate. With the election in Alabama, we no longer have a pro-life majority in the U.S. Senate. We have 49 pro-life votes.
Wow.
Now we have people like Senator Joe Manchin in West Virginia, Senator Joe Donnelly in Indiana, who have campaigned for years as pro-life, but haven't lived up to that once they came to Washington, D.C. and fell lockstep with the Democratic National Committee. So we'll see what happens. I think the Senate, they're going to push for a Senate vote on the 20-week pain-capable bill, really hoping those vulnerable senators, because of the midterm election, people like Joe Manchin, people like Joe Donnelly, will actually vote pro-life and vote in line with their constituents back home in West Virginia, Indiana. But we'll see. I think this is the 2018 year is going to be a very big year for the pro-life movement because we've got to elect more pro-life U.S. senators. But then we've got to hold the U.S. Senate accountable. And that's really been my concern all along after 2016. For a time, we did have that majority in the U.S. Senate, and we failed to act on it.
Yeah. Yep, I'm with you, Kristen. And 2018 is so crucial. That's almost my listeners are probably very tired of me saying that. But we're facing another watershed moment where individuals are going to have to take responsibility for getting involved in their own states and organizing, finding out when the primaries are, because real pro-lifers, really strong, passionate conservatives have only a chance in the primary, and even that, it's hard for them. And without the support of people listening, financial, working in the campaigns, getting the word out, they will not prevail. Kristen Hawkins, the founder and president of Students for Life, is a real champion. And Kristen, I just pray that God will help you to keep your focus and hand to the plow and don't look back and no compromising. And you've shown that you don't do that. And I'm so grateful. I am so grateful. I've told you that before and I'm telling you that again. So, Kristen, go in there and tell them gently the truth, okay?
Thank you so much, Sandy, for everything.
Okay. All right. Talk to you soon. Kristen Hawkins, Students for Life. Next, we're going to talk to about the pro-life movement in the black church. Some people feel that the black church doesn't have as much passion on this issue as they should. If that's the case, why not? Stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Well, one thing that President Trump had said, because when he really found out what abortion was, he did what I did in 1983. Prior to 1983, I was pro-choice. Mm-hmm. And I would say a woman has a right to do abortions and all that. I had secret abortions myself. But when I found out what abortion was and that it was killing a human being in the womb of a woman, in the womb of a mother, without the baby having a say-so or a lawyer, that was too close to slavery for me. So when I was born again in 83, I also received Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior and became a voice and an advocate for life from the womb to the tomb. That means the baby, the poor people, the sick people, the elderly people, people who are unjustly incarcerated. And so President Trump, when he looked at abortion and said, my God, you rip little babies out of the womb of their mothers and tear them apart, he said, that's wrong. That's evil. And he said, when I'm elected, we'll stop. So he gave us the Mexico City policy, a pro-life justice in Justice Gorsuch, and many other things that he is doing to correct that. So it's really time for America across the board to repent, like I had to do, and to say it was wrong to kill those little babies. And I have had the problems in my own body, some of the issues that you're discussing. I just was treated for cervical cancer many years ago and was healed, thank God. Mm-hmm. And I had some problems with my breast and all that, but the Lord was very gracious and merciful to me. So we just need to repent in America. And I know it'll take longer than we have today to verify your facts, but your facts are 200% accurate, except don't call us our race and your race. Mm-hmm. We've got to reconcile to God and say, Lord, we made a mistake. We thought we were different races. We're different nations, every nation, every tongue, every tribe, yes, but we're the human race. And so we need to repent and get it right in America.
That was Dr. Alveda King. Of course, she's the niece of Dr. Martin Luther King. I know you've heard Alveda speak. Every time I hear her, she is just such a blessing. You can tell that God's power has just taken over her life. And of course, she's one of the strongest pro-life advocates in our culture right now. The issue that she touched on is something we want to talk about next. On this anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the 45th anniversary, the conversation goes to what Alveda sort of alluded to, and that is the difference in the response of, okay, we'll say the white community and the black community. Through my years of working in this movement, I have had so many fine black pastor and activist friends that I honestly thought that the black church was just as concerned about this issue as the white church. I didn't see a distinction, but my next guest feels it's not enough. And so I want to talk to him because his name is Joseph Parker. He is a pastor. He's the director of outreach and intercession for the American Family Association and for Urban Family Communications, out of which comes Urban Family Talk. Joseph actually has a show on Urban Family Talk. Joseph, before you did this, did you pastor a church?
Yes, I've been a pastor for most of the last 42 years, yes.
So are you still pastoring?
Yes, I'm pastoring at St. James AME Church in Leland, Mississippi.
Okay, all right, well, good. That gives us a good backdrop. So, all right, you heard my analysis, but from your perspective, I want to ask you this first. When did you personally get motivated on this issue? What was that catalyst, that thing that happened in your life where you suddenly realized that life really is sacred and worth fighting for? What happened?
Well, you know, Sandy, I remember back in 1993, I was pastoring in North Mississippi at the time, St. Paul, and actually I served for a short time. I was serving as a pastor of St. Paul United Methodist Church at the time. But the Lord just really dropped, I guess I would call it, a mantle on me in the midst of, there were many demonstrations in around 93 when people were doing sit-ins, preventing people from going to abortion clinics, and God was doing a work in our nation and in the church. And during that time, it was like a mantle, a burden to just fell on my heart that I need to be doing more, I need to be addressing this issue as a believer and a pastor. And so that's when I really got started getting involved, but it was 1993.
Okay, so since that time, at that time, what was the state? Are we going to have to say black church against Alveda's direction, which I'm really on her side on this, but we have to make distinctions in order to understand humanly. At that time, mm-hmm. in 1993, how was the black church feeling, speaking, talking about abortion?
Well, sadly, it really didn't seem to be much of an issue then, and I guess, and Sandy, I guess I would say I do hear what Dr. Alveda King, and I understand the distinction, but by and large, as a whole, the church, I think, is not nearly where it needs to be in terms of addressing it, but sadly, by and large, the African-American church has been largely asleep at the wheel on the issue, so much so that, for example, today, one out of every three abortions is black, so that means 33% or more of the abortions are black, whereas we're only around 13% of the population. So sadly, no ethnic group aborts at a higher rate as the African-American community in our nation. And so it's our issue as a community, but sadly, it's been so politicized, rather than being addressed as a biblical issue, you have many people that don't even realize how hugely it affects our community. And I think of specifically Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 19, powerfully speaks clearly from the mind and the heart of God. What he says to us as the church, he says, today I've given you the choice between life and death, between blessings and curses. Now I call on heaven and earth to witness the choice you make. Oh, that you would choose life so that you and your descendants might live. Again, that's Deuteronomy 30, 19. God is saying that to his people across the board. Black, white, you know, black church, white church, everybody, he's calling us to choose life, and that's a mandate to the church of God all over the world, you know.
You know, it's not a surprise or an accident that there are more abortions in the black community than in the other races. Because as you, I'm sure, know, Joseph, Planned Parenthood's, one of their founders was Margaret Sanger. She was the founder. She's still memorialized on their website, and she was a eugenicist, meaning she believed that some races were superior. And one of the publications of Planned Parenthood, her organization before Planned Parenthood, one of the early publications said that black people were human weeds that needed to be exterminated. So when Planned Parenthood planned their clinics, they planned them in the most highly populated, like inner city, highly saturated with black and Hispanic people, so that they could be available to do more abortions in those communities. It's not an accident, Joseph.
Not at all. And sadly, Sandy, I think in our culture today, people are so heavily trying to use the term racist to accomplish what they want to accomplish. I would say the most racist organization in the world, I believe, is Planned Parenthood. They kill more black babies in 3 weeks than the KKK killed black folks in 150 years, and that's easily documented. Yet, sadly, they're not characterized as being racist at all. They're, again, as you said, the founder, Margaret Sanger, and here's to where it's an example of how deceptive the media can be, and our culture. Probably one of the most racist people that has ever lived was Margaret Sanger, but she's not characterized that way. She's held up as a heroine, sadly, even in the black community. And to this day, in the Black History Museum in Washington, D.C., they have a statue of her in the Black History Museum, which is crazy. But that's the reality of how deception works in our culture.
You know, I would also further link Margaret Sanger and the eugenicists of the 30s with Nazi Germany and Hitler. Hitler and his bunch were consumers and they believed the same way Margaret Sanger believed, because they believed that their race was superior. It's an amazing story. And Joseph, so when you tell this story to other pastors or other black leaders, what kind of a response do you get?
Well, you know, I guess I should put it like this, Sandy. Part of what's been an emphasis for me is, and this is one of the things I do with Urban, we have these events we call it a Festival for Life, where we aggressively go into churches that allow us to come do a biblical, it's a media presentation about the need for the church to biblically address this issue. Often, there aren't a lot of settings that even want to address this issue. That's been my experience as a black pastor, where many times they don't even want to discuss the issue. So part of what we do is we basically created an event where that is the issue from a biblical perspective that we address it. And so part of what we have needed to do is aggressively create venues to address it, because by and large, it's avoided. And they stay away from talking about it in a preaching or a teaching or a discussional capacity, by and large, in the African-American community. So there's a huge need for us to decide deliberately, address it biblically and from the standpoint of God's mind and heart on the issue. So, but often it's avoided, sadly.
Hey, Joseph, how could people, if there are lots of people listening, a lot of black listeners, a lot of black churches represented, maybe even some black pastors listening, if they wanted to link with you and this Festival of Life presentation, how could they do that?
Well, they could simply email me at jparker@afa.net. Again, jparker@afa.net. Or just call us at Urban Family Talk at 662-844-5036, extension 381. And I would say, Sandy, we've done more than 50 of these events over the last several years in different parts of the nation. And we basically can take it anywhere. But part of the goal is that it's an event that helps the church to begin to aggressively address an issue that's huge in the mind and heart of God. And the church needs that. And, of course, it's not just black churches. We go into black, white, Hispanic, anyone that opens the door. But it helps the church address this from a spiritual warfare perspective and a biblical perspective that helps the leadership and the church as a whole to begin to do something to address the issue.
And okay, so, let me repeat.
That's how they can get in touch with, again, jparker@afa.net.
Okay, jparker@afa.net. And we will put afr.net. AFA.net, sorry.
AFA.net, yes.
Yeah, AFA.net. And we'll put the phone number, and we'll also just repeat the Festival of Life so that you can remember and you can get in touch with Joseph if this is something that you'd like to embrace in your church, and I hope you'll seriously consider it. Joseph, you know, when there are studies done on abortion, the effect of it, it's really interesting. I've been at this for a long time. I've done so many radio shows on this. My own unscientific observation is that women, some women don't regret, but most women, I think, do in various degrees. Some are depressed forever, and some just have mild regret, and others it doesn't seem to bother them at all, but I think that percentage is small. Some men are profoundly affected. Okay, my question is, we only have a minute or so left here. Do you think there's a difference? Would you have a way of knowing between how women in the black church feel about this issue and the men?
Well, I guess I tend to think it's different in the way that it's different between men and women as a whole. I think tragically often people will say it's a women's issue. But sadly, the reality is 100% of the time there's a man in the picture. And the fact is often men are the engines behind many abortions, because many times you have a woman that's either on the fence or she wants to keep her baby, but a man that basically is functioning as a wimp who won't take care of his own responsibility he's in the background demanding you're going to get an abortion. So many times it's the men that are not wanting the responsibility of a child who are forcing the issue. So often, sadly, men are the engines behind many of these abortions rather than, and so that doesn't sound like a woman's issue to me. That doesn't sound like a woman's choice to me. That's a culture that has allowed men to hide their hand, but to perpetuate the tragedy of abortion. So,
you know, time and time again, the stories that I've heard and I've read, that so many women, I don't think any woman is eager like, gee, I can't wait to call the abortion clinic. It is a traumatic event for them and many times very painful. I don't care what they say. And so I think that women might be the drivers of this in the black church if they found their voice. So, and righteous men of God who are black, and there are plenty of them, heaven knows. I've been in rooms filled with them. And so we just need to say, rise up, men of God, of all colors and races, and women too. And let's do the right thing on behalf of our righteous God that we serve. And by the way, it's jparker@afa.net, jparker@afa.net. Go to our Facebook page and you'll get more information about this festival of life. Joseph, thanks for all you do for AFA, and thanks for being my guest today.
Thank you, Sandy.
All right, Sandy Rios on this anniversary of Roe versus Wade.